Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. Our episode today is brought to you by NetSuite, and we'll tell you a little bit more about that a little bit later. It's just another Tuesday in Trump world, and who better to describe what's going on than our friend A.B. Stoddard, who joins us again. Thanks for coming in. Appreciate it very much.
Thanks for having me, Charlie.
Well, let's start talking about it. I want to get to Mooch. I want to get to ISIS. I want to get to the new poll on Biden and the president's walk back on gun control. What a surprise that is, said no one, really. But let's start talking about the economy, because we're getting all kinds of odd messages from the White House, which is there's nothing to worry about. There's no panic. But there's all sorts of signals that they're scrambling around for something to do. So give me your state of play on the White House and these recession fears, and what that would mean for them in 2020, which is pretty obvious.
Yeah, I do think that if it were any White House and any president, and when we were seeing recessionary signals, and there was behavior, in the economy, in business investment, et cetera, there were bad indicators. It's not good to talk about a recession because you don't want to egg it on. You don't want people to consumer confidence to plunge and people to, you know, hoard, basically, not spend, not hire. And so it's understandable that they want to get out there and tell us everything's hunky-dory. So that's apart from the Trump inishness of all of this, like the Navarro, Peter Navarro out there denying, you know, who pays the tariffs, Trump doing the same, all the crazy mania, the harassment of the Fed, all that. So we would start with that, right? That you don't want to egg on a recession, and right, we're not technically in recession. But once you leave that topic, there are certainly indications, longest bull run ever reached its record in June. What goes up must come down. Certainly all the sugar high of the tax cut is gone. Middle America didn't feel it enough. It was so politically toxic, the Republicans couldn't run on it in the midterms. So you can't do that again. You're not going to stimulus spend. We're at high deficit. And you can't really go into a series of reductions in interest rates because interest rates are low and the president wants them to be lower. So he's out of tools in the arsenal. So they've been saying, well, we don't have any plans because everything's great. And of course, like I said, they've used the weapons that they would need in the case of a downturn. And so now we hear about the payroll cut, and that makes sense that they would want to have some way to address it, because this is a lot.
They're denying that now. They're now saying,
of course, that's what they always do. Yeah. But it would make sense, right, Charlie, that if you think about how actually far away the election is, that a panicking, cornered Trump, you know, will want a tool, right? Will want a gun in a sling. So that makes sense, even though they're denying it, and maybe it never comes to pass. Getting Congress to do anything, you know, it would be very difficult. It's interesting. What is real, though, even if you say we're not in recession, and the indicators are strong enough and everything's going strongly enough, the trade war is a disaster. And there's increasing, it's very obvious that the people around the president have concluded, because they're leaking this to the press. Last Thursday, it was, you know, reports about the Treasury Secretary begging the president not to designate China a currency manipulator a couple weeks back. Him doing it anyway, thinking it would bring the Chinese to the table. Of course, it didn't. All these things are being leaked out from around the president. He's on his own. He's acting without listening. The new tariffs. Oh, it was a crazy idea to begin with. And we had to back him off of, you know, a fraction of them. And we told him he'd ruin Christmas. And they're constantly leaking about how he's the Lone Ranger on this. And he has no plan. And it's simply an escalation. And so I do think that tells people who are making decisions about investment that there's just uncertainty for as far as the eye can see. What they should be worried about.
Right, and that is the key word, I think, is uncertainty. And I remember when Republicans and conservatives back during the Obama years, this was one of the main complaints, that that Obama had injected too much uncertainty into the markets. And, you know, but it's nothing compared to now. We don't know what's going to happen. And so much of this is completely self-inflicted. But I think that's also I can never tell whether the president is gaslighting us or actually doesn't know how the economy works. I mean,
or both.
Does he understand how the international economy works, the interdependence, who pays the tariffs and all of that. But I do think he understands about the danger to his brand. It, you know, we may not go into a recession in 2020. A lot of these surveys of economists say, you know, well, by the, you know, end of 2021 or something like that. But if the stock market thinks we're going to go into a recession, if it signals a recession, that's devastating to the president because he has built that, you know, his own brand around that Dow Jones average, you know, around winning and around prosperity. This whole speech about, you know, even if you hate me, you have to vote for me, you know, because of the 401k. But the uncertainty factor, I think, is huge. And I think it's rattling the administration because I think Republicans completely understand that this is a president who's not going to be able to survive a downturn in the economy. I mean, it's not going to be like it may be, you know, 2-3 points, but the difference between 43 points approval rating and 38 is the difference between being remotely competitive and being blown out.
Absolutely. The economy is what he has.
Right. This is it.
And so it's what he has to get over the electoral college threshold. His base, he can always talk about judges and all that stuff. But the economy is the math to reelection. And it is true that it wouldn't have to be a recession, like you said, but even the indicators of the beginning of a downturn would so spook people. He wants to convince us all that it's roaring and will continue to roar. And I do think on the subject of China and a deal and the farmers, I just believe that the farmers who know more about trade than the president have figured out that there isn't actually a deal afoot, and that the Chinese are not, there's not a negotiation, there's just an escalation. The Chinese have figured they can wait this guy out and get an ag-only deal when he panics before election late next summer. And he'll tell us it's the greatest thing ever, but they'll know. And their supply chains have been reordered, and they're really suffering. And that's not a suburban mom who was trending away from the Republican Party anyway. That's his base. So that's going to be really interesting to see if he continues to dig in like he promises us he will on the tariffs, because, of course, the Chinese are paying for them, you know, as we get into November and then February and then the spring.
Well, and also, you know, you put that together with the announcement, you know, that U.S. Steel is laying off employees up in Michigan. So you have the failure to really bring back those manufacturing jobs, plus the hammering of the agriculture sector, and that does not bode well for him or for the Republicans in the upper Midwest, where they absolutely have to win if they want to win the Electoral College. But the other part of his brand, of course, is the whole hashtag winning, and the Chinese are hearing and listening to absolutely everything that we are, and they are seeing the president who has a much weaker hand going into this election and who might actually panic. So if you're sitting across the negotiating table from somebody that you can wait out anyway, but you sense that panic, if there's going to be a deal, it might not be a good deal. And, you know, from within the Trump world, I mean, the number one thing you can do to shore up the economy or to stop this uncertainty is to cut a trade deal with China. But if he cuts a trade deal with China that looks like a complete capitulation, well, that again, you know, for a guy that runs on he fights and he wins, not a good scenario. Not to mention how much harder that's going to be if Hong Kong blows up.
What's so interesting is that he could actually, if he stood for the values of our country and talked about solidarity with the human rights and democratic rights of those protesting in Hong Kong, he might actually be able to sort of, you know, bring Xi more to the table. he refuses to because he's hoping that being nice to Xi and protecting his, you know, dictatorship and his intimidation of Hong Kong will help him at the negotiating table. And just as you said, Charlie, they read every panic tweet we do. The things that this man is saying, that we need a weak dollar and it's all, you know, Jerome Powell's fault. It's like, you know, the Chinese know that Jerome Powell is acting in accordance with the uncertainty produced by a trade war, not the other way around. And so when Trump tries to tell his voters that the pain they're feeling is all because of Jerome Powell or a strong dollar, all that matters is that the Chinese are laughing and they know they can wait them out longer.
Well, just turn it around. Imagine if we were watching the Chinese fight with one another like this, what that would do to strengthening our hand at the negotiating table. So speaking of, and this is not the most important story of the day, but I'm a little bit fascinated by it. Speaking of the things the President of the United States is tweeting out at this time of international stress and possible economic challenges, he is apparently obsessed with Anthony Scaramucci, actually putting out a tweet this morning with a highly produced video of all the times Mooch said that he loved him. So, look, a lot of people have, you know, bailed on Trump in various ways. What is it about Mooch that seems to be getting under his skin so much? Why is he obsessed with this?
That's so interesting. Maybe because Mooch keeps getting so many TV interviews. And
he's from his world, right? I mean, that
whole... Basically. But it's a very interesting sort of backstory about how Ivanka and Jared wanted to get rid of Sean Spicer, and they convinced the dad to bring him on. But anyway, as we know, Scaramucci did everything he could to ingratiate himself with President Trump really long before he had those 11 days in the White House. I mean, we know that. And the fact that he had someone, because there's no way the president knows how to make a video like that, working on that while he had another grandchild overnight, by the way. And as you said, there are all these other crises that are much more important. Is just, I mean, his pettiness just knows no bottom. It's so incredible. When I saw that, you still find yourself taken aback at being taken aback, but I was.
Yeah.
I just couldn't believe it.
And then you also tweeted out something about Scaramucci's wife or his ex-wife and his divorce, and it's that moment where Trump just drops any pretense of any sort of civility whatsoever, and he goes after the family. I have to admit that I have really mixed feelings about Scaramucci. I know that some of my colleagues think, look, anyone who agrees with us at this particular fine, we shouldn't have a purity test, but it does feel like Scaramucci. Sort of like Omarosa, just one of those guys that, let me start over here. I'd be able to take him more seriously if he was not on television begging for his job back like 5 minutes ago. I mean, the suck up was, up so recently. Clearly, I want my job back. I want to be able to do this, and the fawning praise over the years when, look, he had to know what he says he knows now. I mean,
they all do. Yes, of course. And he's telling us that those who haven't crossed the, river to come to Jesus are telling him this stuff privately, and we're supposed to be heartened by that. But, I'm all for the public shaming of these people who are still hiding their feelings. I really am because, at some point, all the Republicans who've put their party over country, they will have to. There will be a day of reckoning. And we talk about this a lot. But the second part that Mooch thinks he can actually get, critical mass together for a primary challenge when the RNC is now is wholly owned subsidiary of the Trump Organization is laughable.
Yeah, and I guess part of the as I look back over what's happened to the Republican Party and to the conservative movement, it was this decision to get into bed with some sort of freaky people, not freaky, but
right.
with some sketchy characters that you make alliances with people who, this is the essence of Trumpism. You bring in the Corey Lewandowskis, you bring in the Paul Manafort, you bring in the Steve Bannons and stuff. And maybe those alliances were not such a good idea. And so embracing the Omarosas and embracing the Scaramuccis, I think, ought to be treated with a great deal of caution. Although, he's certainly trolling. The big guy. Okay, so let's just switch to one of the least surprising stories of the day. And I guess maybe this is a sign of my cynicism. The president already backing off, Donald Trump already backing off any suggestion that he was going to go for significant gun control legislation. The reason I say it was the least significant was to imagine Trump making a bold Declaration of Independence from the NRA and from the pro-gun base always seemed to be fanciful to me.
Right. And I mean, in past aftermaths, plural, of shootings, the president has said unbelievable things. I'm not afraid of the NRA. He was actually on camera once supporting confiscation. I mean, he has gone way to the other side in his rhetoric, as we know. And I do think he feels political pressure to do something because he knows there will be more mass shootings before next November. And that this is an atrocity that we have a Congress that refuses to act. So he's been saying privately he thinks the NRA is in shambles. As we know, Charlie, it doesn't matter how many people flee the NRA and how many investigations there are into their spending or whatever. It is really cheap to get on the internet and scare your membership about Rush Limbaugh's message, which is that the president is going to lose re-election if he separates himself from his base on the Second Amendment. This is not expensive. It takes like one staffer, right? So it doesn't matter that the NRA is weak. It matters that they put the fear of God in their membership, and that the motivation comes at the grassroots, doesn't really have to come from the NRA calling Pat Toomey's office. And so his reversal was so, I mean, I expected him to sort of reverse in October after many bipartisan, you know, meetings of several hours each time to even put on the show, right? You put on the show, we couldn't come to an agreement. But the fact that he would reverse this quickly is really remarkable and obviously politically stupid.
Yeah, well, and you know, the point you're making is significant. And a lot of people, I think, focus too much on the NRA itself and the amount of money that they put into the campaigns. You know, it is a grassroots movement, though. And frankly, the Democrats have given the NRA, or some Democrats, have given the NRA a gift by embracing proposals like mandatory buybacks of certain kinds of guns. Now, mandatory buyback is gun confiscation. And so it's like the fever dream of the NRA that they're going to come and grab your guns. And then what do some of the candidates do? Saying, we kind of do. We'll pay you for it, but we're still going to take your gun away from you. But what is fascinating about this is the polls are so overwhelming. There's no question about it that this issue, which Republicans have always thought of kind of, you know, something that was their ace in the hole, has now become an existential threat. And Donald Trump seems to understand both the polls, I mean, this is something he obsesses about, and also I never like to speculate about what he actually thinks goes on in his mind, but he seems to have sort of a visceral reaction to the gun issue. And yet, despite that, despite what his gut is telling him and what the polls are telling him, he's just not going to budge. And, you know, so what's the main factor? Just fear of allowing an inch of daylight between himself and his base?
Yeah, he knows that everyone is going to be howling out on social media and on talk radio, and that he and Ann Coulter is going to join in along with Rush Limbaugh, and that he's going to be painted to his base as a sellout. And the polling is overwhelming, Charlie. I mean, the voluntary buyback is like at 73%. The assault weapons ban, I mean, the numbers are unbelievable. And they're obviously heading in one direction. And we haven't seen our last mass shooting. So you're right. I think it is an existential threat to the Republicans. And you know, we have always seen single issue activists only in two camps, pro-life, maybe some pro-choice women. And gun rights. If people start voting only on gun control, who are totally disinterested in other policy and in politics, and vote only on this issue because they can't put their kid on a bus in the morning, that is going to be that when that day comes, and I think it will, and it might not be next year. You know, that will make the difference. But without people voting because their votes are blocked, anyone who thinks about gun control and why doesn't the Congress get together just doesn't understand how many single issue, you know, gun rights voters are coming out. And every step of the elections, local, state, you know, federal. And so that's going to be an interesting, now that the Democrats have finally embraced this rhetoric, because they no longer, they don't, represent small towns anymore. They don't represent regions in the South or rural areas. For a while, they thought it was a liability, and now they are embracing it. So it'll be interesting to see what happens with the numbers and if they make a difference next year.
Well, and they still do need to win the Electoral College in places like Michigan. Look, I understand. I'm a Second Amendment supporter, and I understand a lot of the arguments around this, but I've never understood the argument against the background check, and apparently the vast majority of Americans don't either. I don't understand the arguments that would, well, you know, say that Americans, we really ought to fight for the right for Americans to have these high capacity magazines, which are insane. And the red flag laws seem to be exactly the kinds of things that conservatives have been talking about in terms of mental health, in terms of behavior. So there's a common sense agenda there, red flags, background checks, high capacity magazines. But you sort of get the sense that nobody's going to do anything because they are paralyzed. Okay, I want to talk about Joe Biden. Joe Biden's still hanging in there. A new CNN poll showing him with a lead, but there's lots of questions about, you know, whether he's going to be able to hold that. So I want to go through those numbers when we come back. But here first, a message from our sponsor. Look, if you don't know your numbers, you don't know your business. But the problem that growing businesses have that keeps them from knowing their numbers is their hodgepodge of business systems. They have one system for accounting, another one for sales, another one for inventory. It's just a big, inefficient mess, taking up too much time, too many resources, and of course, that hurts the bottom line. So we're introducing NetSuite by Oracle, the business management software that handles aspects of your business in an easy-to-use cloud platform, giving you the visibility and control you need to grow. With NetSuite, you save time, money, and unneeded headaches by merging together sales, financing, accounting, orders, and HP instantly, you know, right from your desktop or your phone. That's why NetSuite is the world's number one cloud business system. And right now, NetSuite is offering you valuable insights with a free guide, Key Strategies to Grow Your Profits. And you can find that at netsuite.com/bulwark. That is netsuite.com/bulwark to download your free guide, These Key Strategies to Grow Your Profits. netsuite.com/bulwark. We're back with A.B. Stoddard. Okay, let's talk about Joe Biden. New CNN poll showing that he's got a double-digit lead on everybody. He's at 29 percentage points, which, interestingly enough, is the combined number for Bernie Sanders and for Elizabeth Warren, who are at 15 and 14, respectively. Kamala Harris has dropped all the way down to 5%. So what's interesting to me is my takeaway from that is that Joe Biden's had a pretty rough summer. He's taken a lot of brickbats, and yet he's still holding on to that lead. Nobody has really broken through, with the possible exception of Elizabeth Warren, who seems to be getting a little bit of traction.
It is remarkable because Warren has definitely, after a very bad start when people counted her out next to John Delaney, I believe she was the first. I mean, he announced, you know, like in 1971. So I think she announced on New Year's Eve or something, and everyone was laughing at her, and she had all her Pocahontas problems, which are real, that she's sort of politically tone deaf, and she's non-flashy, and to her credit has run this really grinded out, non-flashy, voter-by-voter campaign where she really is finally gaining traction with a hyper-engaged primary electorate. And she has a real advantage in Iowa. That's the first place, and it's really, really white. So her base is white and progressive, and Biden's is non-college white and non-white and moderate. That is usually the coalition that gets you the nomination in the Democratic Party. But anything can change now. We're in Trump's America. So maybe that's been reordered. But she could win Iowa and throw him off his game, but she does have to. She would have to expand her coalition, and thus far, it seems like he holds on through everything.
Yeah, it does.
Funny behavior, missteps, misstatements, a terrible first debate. Although I thought his second debate was really strong. Mm-hmm. I mean, maybe it was because of low expectations, but I thought that he was willing to come out at the radicals and say I'm different, and I thought that you know, I really thought that that was necessary, and I thought it was that he didn't the shy away from that was telling, and plus he was prepared, you know, on for long answers and stuff like that. But surely he can't remember, you know, where he is or whatever's going on with his age, and that it, you know, that could be a problem. But if you look at the numbers that matter about a candidate who can win versus represents my value, that consistently in all the polling favors Biden and favors electability. Yeah, and so that's Elizabeth's challenge.
And there's this tape of Jill Biden up in New Hampshire basically saying, yeah, you know, this is the pitch. You know, you might like other candidates better. They might have better health care plans. But the key here is who's going to beat Donald Trump, who's going to win this election. And quite frankly, I thought it was refreshingly you know, blunt. It was like, yeah, that's pretty much, this is going to be a referendum on Donald Trump. The biggest threat I think there's two major threats to Biden. You know, number one is this question of age and whether he's going to have some sort of a you know, fatal gaffe or total epic meltdown in a debate. Although I think we've seen a lot of people recover from bad debates in the past. Or, and I this is higher on my list, actually, is the consolidation of the progressives behind a candidate. So that's why, you know, you add together Bernie Sanders and you add together Elizabeth Warren. But it's not totally clear to me that if Bernie Sanders flames out, drops out of the race, that those voters all flock to Elizabeth Warren because of the phenomenon that you just described. That there is a sort of an underlying pragmatism, it seems, at least for the moment, among these Democratic primary voters.
Right. So that's the party establishment's worst fear is the Bernie and Elizabeth numbers padded together eclipsing Biden, and that she is the nominee and loses to Trump. So there's no centrist alternative to Biden. That's the nightmare scenario. But you're right. We don't know that Bernie. That she consolidates Bernie's support if he were ever to drop out. He has faded in many polls. In the CNN poll that you mentioned, our freshest one, he's ahead of her. He's number two. So that's really interesting. I also think that Bernie Sanders intends to go all the way to the convention and help reelect Donald Trump, because I don't think that he cares a hoot about the Democratic Party. And I think it's all about him. So I think he is a... not a unifying force, to put it mildly. I could be wrong. And I do think that that what's interesting is these really weirdo second choice indicators, where a lot of times Bernie is the Biden voter's second choice and vice versa, which is really strange. Like if you're for Bernie and he drops out, you want another old white man. I don't know what's going on, and maybe that doesn't bear out in 4 months, but that certainly makes it a mystery. And I think you're right. The younger voters clearly want what they want, and the older voters want what they need. And we're just going to have to see how many show up in the primary vote, this winter in the primary to actually determine the nominee versus young kids wanting to show up next year.
Okay, so
just for the general election.
So what happened to Kamala Harris? I mean, she was the hot candidate, the flavor of the day. She's down to 5% in the CNN poll. This is a national poll. But it is striking, isn't it, that neither she nor Cory Booker, you know, African-American candidates, seem to be getting much traction among African-American voters who seem to be sticking with Joe Biden.
Well, African-American voters, and I do a lot of looking into this because it's so interesting and it's so predictive of who's going to be the nominee. They are very pragmatic and they're culturally conservative, especially the older ones. They don't care about Joe Biden's position on the Hyde Amendment. They don't give it two thoughts. They know that, you know, all the segregation stuff meant nothing to them. It was like he was in the Senate and all the segregationists were chairman of the committees and he was trying to get stuff through. And so it's and they are afraid that Obama brought us Trump. And so they are, as I said, they're pragmatic and they're afraid. Booker, I thought, would be more popular by now. Kamala Harris is a great package. She's incredibly accomplished. She's incredibly smart. She's attractive. She has an infectious smile and laugh. Really, people had very high hopes for her. She continues to do quiet work in places like South Carolina that could bear fruit later. But I thought the debate bump when she attacked Biden was really overrated, because what did people see in that? Oh, that she can debate Donald Trump. Well, I'm with Bill Kristol. I don't think Donald Trump's going to show up at the debates next year if he doesn't feel like it. And I don't think, I think Biden could sit there calmly in his sweet way and do a grandpa debate with Trump and win hands down. So I don't think you need to be like flame coming out of your nostrils to debate Donald Trump. But she showed that she was serious about winning and she doesn't want to just be VP, right? So she came at the king and she swung and she got some CBC endorsements among the Black caucus, but she also got some blowback. And her biggest problem has been healthcare. It's the biggest, it's the most important issue to the Democratic Party. She is so not interested in policy. If she was the way Warren is, she would have done the work. She doesn't know the details. She keeps flip-flopping. And it's really, it's a huge liability because it makes people think that they can't really trust her and she's unserious. The people who really care about this stuff. And as I said, it was the number one issue in 2018. And I think to Democratic voters, if we're not in a big, you know, pre-recession downturn and the economy is still in good shape, the healthcare will absolutely be the number one issue for them next year.
I find that amazing. I find it incredible that she is continuing to sort of walk back and walk around her position on healthcare, you know, and this is no longer early in terms of figuring out where you stand there. So, the you know, obviously, you know, she was, when she went after Biden, you know, part of what she wanted to telegraph was, well, I'm the prosecutor. Remember that I was the prosecutor.
She's going to prosecute the case against Trump.
You know, and her record in California is, shall we say, mixed from the perspective of, I think, many of the Democrats. So I see that Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren are both out with their criminal justice reform packages, which is it too cynical or to suggest that these are attempts to appeal to African-American voters? Because I guess I'm a little skeptical that that those proposals are going to create enough distance between themselves and Joe Biden that it's going to make a difference. But obviously what they want to do is they want to highlight Joe Biden's support for the 1994 bill, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Do you think that will have any get any traction peeling away African-American voters from Biden?
You know, I don't think African-American voters will listen to them until Biden's in real trouble and they feel that they don't have another choice. Right now, they are, Bernie and Elizabeth Warren continue to do poorly with African-American voters. And for Bernie, this isn't new. This is like, goes back to 2016, okay? And so Elizabeth Warren has done her level best to talk about maternal mortality rates and in the Black community and all these, you know, she does what she can. And I think she's probably made some inroads because she meets with the right groups and is really earnest in her efforts. And she's tireless, but it's not showing up in the polling. And like I said, I at this point, I do think that they would have to see Biden tumble for them to start reassessing their choices, because they are with Clinton's because she was Bill Clinton's wife. Let's just be honest. That was why they're with Hillary, because she was the safe choice. And then they went to Obama because he opened up this sort of new world where white Americans were saying, we have to have him. He's going to change everything. We have to take this risk. And this is a huge opportunity. And then the Black voters left Hillary and went to him. But I think it would take a lot for them. I think it would take Biden to be in serious trouble for them to reassess and go with. I mean, I do think that to the older Black voters, I don't think they're looking for a radical. And I think that Bernie and Elizabeth are promising a revolution. And I, for one, am in no mood for, we just went through a failed revolution and I'm not feeling so great about it. So I think that they would probably be the last ones to leave Biden.
So one last question about this, before I move on to another topic here. The one thing that indicator that I missed, I think a lot of people missed, but I'm gonna fess up, was the size of the rallies, Trump rallies which were huge, which should have been an indication that something big was happening, something that was a little bit unprecedented. Elizabeth Warren did have a big turnout, right? Yesterday she had 12,000 people turn out, which is pretty impressive. So is this an indicator that we are perhaps undervaluing her stock at the moment?
Right. Well, that is why she needs to be watched, because she's doing really well in Iowa, and that's the first vote, and she is hyper organized. She's out organized everybody in Iowa. and she's been there for months. Her members of her campaign did this embedding into the community where they show up at non-political community events representing her campaign and have ingratiated themselves to voters across the entire state in every corner. They've volunteered for everything, for caucus night, for this, for that, the fair. And so they have really made an impression upon Iowans, especially, you know, Democratic activists. And I think that will bear fruit. And the experts say that in close contests, her organization could give her a point and a half, as they get into down the road. So that is going to be an interesting factor. But like I said, I think that she just needs and again, Iowa's very white, but she needs a broader coalition, and maybe she'll have that by January.
Okay. So the one thing that strikes me as a potential, plus for Trump going ahead over the next 12 months is something I disagree with him on policy, but ending the war in Afghanistan, having a negotiated settlement, pulling out, would be a promises made, promises kept moment. But this comes at the moment that we get this story where the Pentagon has this is talking about the resurgence of ISIS as a result of some of Trump's policies. So again, very complicated foreign policy challenge for the president.
I know, and Charlie, this is what I always think when you look across the horizon. Syria, Russia with a big nuclear accident that killed 5 scientists, North Korea, China, ISIS, Afghanistan. When you look at this, the election feels very far away. That how long can Trump continue to say, we'll see what happens. Everyone, we're having great phone conversations. And I have great relationships. I mean, it's really, really hard to imagine how he can be defending the missile tests for North Korea months from now, what we're going to expect in the UK, all these things, all this volatility, and the only thing that helps him when he bumbles through these explanations and defenses is that the Democrats are all over the place on national security and foreign policy, that they're basically with him on a lot of this isolation stuff. And they're not even countering him on China. You know, I think Biden and Beto are the only ones who are anti-tariff. They don't know how to come back at him. What'll be interesting is to see, the Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, basically said something. He's concerned about the missile test for North Korea. Trump is not concerned. You know, Lindsey Graham is opposed to him pulling out of Afghanistan. So it might be that the critics are on his own side as they see things unraveling, and they have real data, from the Pentagon, and they have real worries, and they feel as they approach an election where he's going to be, for many of them, a liability, increasingly, just freer to talk about foreign policy in the way that someone like Mitch McConnell wants to, but tries not to.
I do wonder also how Israel is going to play in all of this. We didn't want to talk about the Squad again, but the way this played out with Israel, disinviting two of the members. But it also turning out that their trip had been organized by this group with this really virulent, vicious, anti-Semitic past, MIFTA, or is it MITFA? MIFTA.
I think it's MIFTA.
I'm sorry. It's all over the place. You'll see it on Twitter. It's about 50-50. But this is a group with a really complicated background, to put it mildly. Had published the blood libel against Jews, but I think much more seriously, has celebrated female suicide bombers in the past, and yet there doesn't seem to be the kind of focus on And I wrote this yesterday. If Steve King had been or any other Republican was traveling around the world, with some neo-Nazi organization or organization that had a long track record of support for white supremacist violence. I mean, it would be a career ender, and yet there doesn't seem to be that kind of pushback, and the Democrats are still stuck with it. I mean, Donald Trump, I do think, knows what he is doing by trying to make them the face of the Democratic Party. I don't think it's going to succeed in the long run, but you can see what his strategy is. And frankly, I thought the press conference yesterday was not helpful, particularly as they escalated and suggested that we should cut back on our aid to Israel. So that's not going to be a plus for the Democrats.
I agree with you completely, Charlie. They are an albatross. And you can both think that the Israelis should have either described their concern over MFTA in their original decision, or let members of Congress in there so that they didn't look like they were answering to pressure from Trump, trying to keep his political enemies out of Israel. You can both think that they made a mistake while, you know, accepting that these women are politically toxic to the Democrats and they're anti-Semitic and they're really nothing but trouble. If you're thinking about, you know, a team, a party, where you all have to, you know, row the boat upstream together, they are going to say more anti-Semitic things. They are going to retweet more anti-Semitic things. They will remain a problem going forward. Just like Trump can expect mass shootings, Nancy Pelosi can expect this from these two or three women over and over again. And I just think that you're right. If you're Trump, what else do you have? You're going to do it, and it's going to remain a big liability for the Democrats.
Yeah, this is still the formula that I don't think Donald Trump can win this election, but he doesn't need to win it. He just needs the Democrats to lose it, and I don't think we've actually changed that. Although, I have to say, these poll numbers, we have a couple of pieces in the Bulwark. As you dig down into these poll numbers, there are a lot of reason for him to be extremely worried, and the constituencies where he's losing support, and of course, if the economy goes wobbly at all, it's really difficult to see how he recovers. In fact, of all the things we've been talking about, as you tour the horizon, it's hard to see issues that are going to get a lot better for him. A lot of things can deteriorate. The only hope that he has is to drop $1 billion or $2 billion demonizing the Democrats, making them completely unacceptable, because his underlying fundamentals are not going to get strong.
I agree. One of the most telling numbers I've seen, and I'm sorry I don't have them memorized, but everyone can see the NBC Wall Street Journal poll from Sunday. And obviously, the opposition among college-educated white women is sky high. The support among non-college white men for the president is sky high. And then, you know, everyone else falls somewhere in between. But he has lost dramatic support among non-college white women. They did start voting for Democrats in the midterms. And I think Ron Brownstein and some other people I respect, you know, called this early, that really, I think David Frum as well, that women, I mean, they can't stay high off a good rally and getting mad at NFL players for long. They're going to look at the pocketbook years into this. And if the factory didn't come back to their town, if they were promised a repealed and replaced health care and they didn't get it, if the tax cut didn't help them, and now the farms are ravaged, if not around them, directly in their community, you know, somewhere nearby, they're going to know that these promises weren't kept. And so they are the ones to watch. He can't lose them. He won with a lightning strike. He can't lose them.
Yeah, when you win by a lightning strike, or by different analogy, you know, the ultimate, you know, inside straight, you don't have much of a margin for error. So that's where we are right now. A.B. Stoddard, thank you so much for joining me. I appreciate it very, very much.
Thank you, Charlie. Always good to be with you.
And thank you for listening to the Bulwark Podcast. This episode was brought to you by NetSuite. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow, and we will be doing this all over again.